It's March 23rd, 2016. Welcome to another edition of Bite Marks Cafe, where we serve you the first bite of today's science and technology. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa. To kick off today's show, we're going to hear about a couple of upcoming events. David Chin from the UH Information and Computer Science Program is here to tell us about the next Wetware Wednesday. Then Ruth Gates from UH's Institute for Marine Biology will tell us about the upcoming Distinguished Lecture Series at the Waikiki Aquarium.
And finally, we'll continue our conversation about STEM education, this week specifically focusing on its links with workforce development. Helen Turner from Chaminade University is here, as well as Scott Murakami from UH Community College Office of Workforce Development.
We always welcome your comments and questions as part of that conversation. You can contact us by calling in or sending us a tweet after the break. But first, beyond our shores, Bert, I wanted to know if you wanted to talk a little bit about Apple's announcements, Tim Cook's town hall on Monday. They had some hardware, some software to
announce. Well, you know, I thought it was pretty interesting. It seemed like a little bit of a back to the future kind of announcement. They had, like the iPad, right? When we announced the opportunity to announce the iPad Pro, I think the first things out of our mouth was the fact that it was so big. It was like 15 inches mm-hmm. in size. And I thought, wow, who's going to buy that? Well, so they came out with an iPad Pro, which is 9.7 inches.
Right, the size of the original iPad.
Right, which is really kind of manageable.
They also downsized the iPhone. So even though a lot of geeks rejoiced when they announced larger iPhones, there were a lot of people that preferred that smaller size, mm-hmm. which to me now feels like a toy size. But even I have a coworker who misses the smaller sized phone. So now you can now get the current specs, the good camera, the good battery, and all of that, but in the smaller package, basically the same size as the iPhone 5S, but with all the specs of the 6, it's called the iPhone SE, uh-huh. and it's only $399, probably going to drop to $299 when the next new iPhone comes out, which I think is aimed more at the developing markets and where people are more price sensitive.
So what do you think? I mean, do you think the fact that they have reached the maximum size of these devices and now they are looking back at where they had first started?
Well, it's kind of funny to imagine that they've made it all the way up to the 5.5, 6 Plus or 6S mm-hmm. Plus, and that they might reduce them back down and eventually maybe we'll be watch-sized again or even implants maybe by the time we get there. They also did announce a new software, the iOS 9.3, which has the night shift, which mm-hmm. I think is a great idea because pretty much everybody uses their phone before they go to bed, but that's bad for your eyes.
Mm-hmm. And what, it sort of dims the screen, I guess, so that you can get a little bit more accustomed to the evening setting.
Well, it specifically takes away the blue spectrum, which they say inhibits your serotonin generation, mm-hmm. which you need before you want to, you know, sail off to sleep. So by making your screen less blue, i.e. more orange, it's softer on the eyes.
Yeah. So anyway, that was the Apple announcement. Kind of some interesting things. I mean, I actually would be a little compelled toward maybe getting an iPad Pro, but, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. Time to go shopping, Bert.
Well, anyway, we want to get up to our news guest, and David Chin is here. He's the professor and chair of the Department of Information and Computer Science over at UH, and he's here to tell us about the next Wetware Wednesday. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you, Bert.
Now, you know, Wetware Wednesday, we normally have a chair here for the HTDC folks, you know, the High Tech Development Corporation guys. And every month they do a Wetware Wednesday, and this month actually it's kind of happening in your neck of the woods, right?
Right. So Information Computer Sciences at UH Manoa is sponsoring this month's Wetware Wednesday, and it'll actually be at the Lava Lab, mm-hmm. Which is Jason's specialized lab for visualization. We have a huge video wall that's 3D, and we'll be having lightning talks by various ICS faculty.
Mm-hmm. Now, your department has sort of always been kind of a partner with this Wetware Wednesday. Is that correct?
Since the beginning. That's
yeah, right,
correct.
Right. So, what is the relationship? What is the association? Why do you find it beneficial to maybe have this connection with HTDC and Wetware Wednesday?
Well, I mean, the whole purpose of our program is to get jobs for our students, right? So, by having Wetware Wednesday, we can connect our students with professionals out in the field who are working already and possibly who might be hiring, right? Mm-hmm. So, that's the whole purpose of that, and to, build up the relationship so that people can, if they want, find the people to create a startup and, you know, hopefully build up their companies in Hawaii.
Well, certainly networking is a big part of it for software developers and software engineers. The company I work for goes because we're looking for people frequently, programmers. Now we're looking for a database administrator, and it's a great opportunity in a more relaxed setting to see what the talent is out there and to see what's going on in the community. Now, AT&T recently co-sponsored a hackathon, which was announced at a previous What Were Wednesday. How did that go?
That went great. We had, you know, over 120 participants. The governor was one of our judges. We had a mix of students and professional developers. And in general, I think the projects that came up with the actual apps were much more well-developed this year than last year.
What was the challenge, I guess, at the beginning of that hackathon that kind of get everybody sort of pointed in the right direction?
Well, I think in previous years, you know, we had the challenge that, you know, people weren't really used to doing that sort of thing in Hawaii, right? And so they really weren't sure what to expect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to thank you, Pert, for actually coming and, you know, giving lectures about open government data in the past, you know, to our students to let them know, you know, what they could actually use in their apps.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So do you recall what some of the winning teams developed after the hackathon?
Oh, yeah. So the winning app this year was an app that basically buzzed your boss, you know, whenever you finished a project. And it was sort of a, you know, fun kind of thing.
I would imagine that would be kind of fun because usually projects never really end. That would indicate, you know, a buzz.
So tell us a little bit more about this upcoming What Were Wednesday. It is next week, I believe.
Correct, and, next week, Wednesday.
A great thing to go to after you listen to our show. But you talked a little bit about the Lava Lab and the visualization screen. Is this the Cyber Canoe that
this
we
is,
featured?
Yeah, this is Jason Lee's yeah. Cyber Canoe.
So that describe what we would be able to see when we come down and check out this lab.
Well, you'll be able to see his lab, and you'll be able to hear about some of the research that the faculty at my department are doing. And there'll be free food and networking.
So some of these lightning talks, are you featuring specific, you know, subsections or sub-areas of study for your program?
Oh, yeah. It'll be all sorts of things, you know, from different technologies that are revolutionizing the way we teach computer science, you know, to networking, to cybersecurity, and I'll be talking personally about, you know, how we can figure out your personality just from what you write and make available on the internet or from your emails.
Ooh.
So is this something sort of like sentiment analysis, but a little bit beyond that?
Right, exactly.
Sentiment / personality analysis?
Well, interestingly,
I'm a little scared.
Right.
To see well, what
oh, you should
say
be.
About me.
You should.
There, interestingly, there was a UH researcher previously that I worked with. I ran a message board on the web. Actually, it's still running. It's one of the longest running ones. And we worked with them, gave them a full dump of the entire contents of this message board, debates about everything from rail transit to favorite places to eat lunch. And they were able to see, you know, can we determine, for example, what this person's opinion would be on this social issue or on this political issue? So that's a very interesting area of study.
Oh, yeah. And now we can tell whether you're outgoing or, you know, inward looking.
Okay, so that's got my interest. I think that in and of itself is worth going and
so can we feed it Bert's blog and you can tell us
oh,
all
yeah,
about Bert?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So what, you can take my blog, you can take my Twitter, Facebook,
yep.
All that stuff. Okay, very good. So where can people go to find out about this event?
Well, Hawaii High Tech Development Corporation
HTDC.org, yep.
Right. Sponsor, so you can go to their website htdc.org/whatwereWED, short for Wednesday.
Sounds fantastic.
Good. We'll put that up on our show notes. Thanks, David, for joining us.
Thank you.
And of course, next up is Ruth Gates, and she's the director of the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, and she's here to tell us about the Waikiki Aquarium's Distinguished Lecture Series, which she is
a distinguished lecturer. Yes.
Right. So I want to make that point.
Welcome.
And of course, welcome
Thank
to the
you.
Show.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
Now, you know, I want to congratulate you on a couple of things. You know, there's this ARCS, which is the, let me look it up. It's actually some very prestigious award for college sciences.
It's an impressive acronym.
And it's a recognition for collegiate scientists, and you got the recognition for Scientist of the Year in 2015. I want to congratulate you for that.
Thank you so much.
And of course, you also got recognized by Hawaii Business in 2016 for the 20 for the next 20. Right. I mean, you know. So what does that mean? It's like the 20 people that you should keep your eye on for in the next 20 years. Now that's impressive.
Yeah, it was incredibly flattering, actually. And I think that all of these accolades are incredibly flattering because really what I do is what I love, and that's science and the study of coral reefs. And, of course, educating people along the way.
And I certainly think it's a validation of the importance of science when we're talking about the future of our planet and of our resources and of our civilization even. So definitely congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, let me guess what your talk might be about. Is it going to be about something that you might have learned as a result of your studies on coral?
It is, actually. What I'm going to talk about is how valuable basic science is to driving solutions. And so, you know, I'm talking about the coral reef crisis, the fact that coral reefs are really suffering worldwide, and what we know about their biology, and how we harness that knowledge and think about creative solutions to the problem.
Now, in Hawaii, I mean, you know, there is never a week that goes by where there is some issue, you know, involving our sort of coral, let's say, ecosystem. And it could be from, let's say, bacteria or sediment or maybe algae that's overtaking the reef, or it could be acidification. I mean, there's just a number of different things. How has your research, has it isolated any particular, let's say, effect that's more detrimental than others on the local coral?
So I think arguably elevated seawater temperatures are the most threatening to coral globally. Mm-hmm. And here in Hawaii, we've seen major bleaching events in 2014 and 2015. And bleaching really denotes unhealthy corals and ones that are most likely to die. So we've seen those associated with higher than normal seawater temperatures. But we also know that some of the activities on land that are directly the result of humans' interaction with their coastal waters is having a huge impact on the health of the reefs themselves, from the dropping of anchors and the drag of anchors to the pollution of the water from nutrient runoff, from just a lot of sediments coming in because we've channelized all the waterways and brought them into bays in single point areas. Mm-hmm. So there's these global stressors associated with climate change, the warming of the oceans, the acidifications of the oceans that combine with all these local pressures that really are unique to our setting and actually are directly under our control.
Now, I imagine you're going to be talking a little bit about the research that you do. The Hawaii Institute for Marine Biology has a research facility at Coconut Island.
It does.
Which I always thought is kind of amazing. It's not, you know, it's Gilligan's Island, but it's something much, much greater than that. So when you're at that research facility, certainly it's great to be out on the sea and looking at corals in their natural environment. But what is it that you get up to when you're on Coconut Island?
Everything. I'm just going to leave it. No, I'm not going to leave it there. So it is actually a most amazing place. It's actually really unique in the world because we have this access to the living reef, to the living coastal ecosystems. And we do what you do normally at Marine Labs. We do a lot of diving. We take boats out. We study patterns of change in the environment. But we also have the capacity to take samples from corals, bring them back into the lab, do experiments in environments that are directly fed from water from the ocean where corals, for example, live, and then analyze those samples all the way from the molecules. We can characterize who they are using high-throughput DNA sequencing that we do on the island. We can visualize the animals using some of the most profoundly advanced scanning confocal microscopy available, all the way to a full suite of physiological studies, how they breathe, what they eat, to their behaviors. So we can do it really from the A to Z of science right there on Coconut Island. Mm-hmm. And while we do that, we do it with a community of people who have complementary skills, all studying facets of the coastal ecosystems, marine mammals, sharks, fish. So we have common interest in what we're studying broadly, but non-overlapping programs. So the students have an amazing opportunity there.
When you talk about complementary interest, though, how does the relationship between the Hawaii Institute for Marine Biology and the Waikiki Aquarium go?
So the Waikiki Aquarium has this incredible capacity to reach out into the community, to disseminate science and what we do here at the University of Hawaii to a much broader audience than we would traditionally do as scientists. We tend to talk to ourselves in scientific journals way too much in my opinion. And so the idea is that the Waikiki Aquarium can really touch so many more people. And is this in the pipeline? So we have our results, we can distribute our results, we can talk about the issues that are pivotally important to Hawaii, what the reef means to the people of Hawaii and actually the people of the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, does your work focus around, I guess, coral ecosystems in different areas across the globe, or do you have a focus in Hawaii?
So I focus a lot of our effort in Hawaii because corals are very different. The species assemblages that we find here in Hawaii are very different, say, than the Great Barrier Reef. Mm-hmm. But we do a lot of comparative work. So we have research sites in French Polynesia, American Samoa, Australia, Japan. So we'll repeat some of the same research that we do here in different places to look at fundamental patterns, mm-hmm. attributes in the biology. They're ubiquitous across the planet. So it's so wonderful to work in Hawaii because the reef is so proximal. We can do really high resolution time series work here because we're here 365 days a year. And then we can do spot work in other places to sort of back up our ideas, mm-hmm. to test our hypotheses more broadly.
Are you also, uncovering the fact that there is some resilience that some corals have to some of the stresses that other corals are experiencing?
Absolutely. I'm a cup half full kind of gal. Mm-hmm. And so I, rather than documenting the declines and the death, I'm very interested in looking at the survivors, the reefs that are doing very well where the ones directly adjacent mm-hmm. aren't, or the individual corals on the reef that are very healthy while all the others around them are suffering. And mm-hmm. my perspective is if we could understand, and we are beginning to understand, the basic biology that underpins the resistance, then we could potentially breed corals that are provisioned for mm-hmm. future ocean conditions, mm-hmm. which will be warmer and more acidic.
I like mm-hmm. how you said you're a glass half full person. And, you know, marine biology is an interest of mine. It was my wife's area of study as well. I have to ask, do you follow with breathless anticipation the things that we get to cover? For example, the expeditions to the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, the Okeanos Explorer, the Fall Corps. Is that within your wheelhouse? And are you looking at what they're observing in those pristine environment?
I'm fascinated by what we're seeing and what we don't know. And I think that that's the thing that's so incredible about ocean studies is we have so much left to learn. And with this increasing application of technology and that is moving so fast, we're able to access places and see things and visualize in ways that we would never have imagined. I mean, I think we had a moment in time where we thought we knew everything we had to know. And now we realize, oh, no, we were delusional. We know just a tiny, tiny amount of what this planet has to offer.
Now, can you tell us again where and when this lecture is going to take place? Because I think this is probably something worthy of our attention.
Yes, so I'll be lecturing actually as part of the Waikiki Aquarium's lecture series at the Thurston Memorial Chapel on Punahou, mm-hmm. at Punahou School between 6:30 and 7:30 on April 7th.
Oh, very All good. Right. Okay, so we'll put up a link on our show notes for that. And Ruth, you know, we will have you back on the show to talk about, you know, all the work that you're doing on Coconut Island in a little bit more depth and not, you know, take a little longer than the quick 7 minutes that we just gave you.
Well, this was wonderful. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And let's see, what do we have up next? We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be joined by Helen Turner and Scott Murakami to talk about STEM and workforce development.
How is one program tied to another? How do we make sure that we're building the right pathways? Of course, we'd love your thoughts or questions as part of that conversation, so please give us a call at 941-3689, or from the Neighbor Islands, you can reach us toll-free at 877-941-3689.
And of course, we're monitoring Twitter. You can tweet us your questions at Bite Marks or at Hawaii. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
The founder of Reddit, Alexis Ohanian, proves it helps to have a sense of humor when building a new company.
When Steve Huffman, my co-founder, and I were undergrads, we were looking to start this website, and we wanted to at first call it Snoo, because we hoped people would ask us, oh, what's Snoo? And we'd say, exactly.
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason, Thursdays at 6:30 on Hawaii Public Radio.
¶¶ This week on Bridging the Gap, I'm breaking out the vinyl for a little fun on the turntables. We'll hear some contemporary cumbia from San Francisco's Disco Mas record label, as well as new cuts from the Bacow Rhythm and Steel Band. I'm Mr. Nick. Join me this Saturday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. for Bridging the Gap, here on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Straub Clinic and Hospital and Gourmet Events Hawaii.
Welcome back to Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
And joining us today are Helen Turner and Scott Murakami. Helen is the Dean of the Division of Natural Sciences and Mathematics over at Chaminade University and is an internationally regarded researcher in molecular immunology. And in addition to her position at Chaminade, she holds academic affiliations with the John A. Burns School of Medicine and the Department of Microbiology over at the University of Hawaii.
Scott, meanwhile, is the new Workforce Development Director for the UH Community College Program. He's responsible for the strategic coordination, planning, and development of training programs that support the local economy.
And, of course, how do the different missions and initiatives of STEM and workforce development coordinate with each other? We'd love to hear your questions and comments. And that number to call is 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. We want to welcome you both to Bite Marks Cafe.
Thank you.
Hi, nice to be here.
Now, let's see. We'll start with you, Helen. And, you know, we've kind of talked about STEM from more of the on-the-ground activities of things like robotics and Science Olympiad and Science Fair. And, you know, a lot of the – we've had teachers, we've had students, we've had, you know, groups come on and talk about some of the activities that they've done. And we like to also explore from more of the maybe a little bit, you know, like a little higher level at perhaps the dean level and looking at how does – like Chaminade University sort of look at this whole STEM initiative from the sort of pathways that students get sort of created and moved into a direction of a STEM education.
We're certainly seeing, I mean, Chaminade is a liberal arts school. It always surprises me we see so many students come in who are interested in STEM careers. And I think that's because the schools, the high schools now, and even from the elementary schools upwards, you know, the students are being exposed to the robotics initiatives, to the outreach programs. And there's passion, there's excitement. And I think compared to a few years ago, we're not knocking that out of the students with the high school science experience. I think that the advent of these inquiry-directed curricula, the advent of these amazing programs that we're seeing. You know, what students are doing in high school now is stuff that I did in my final year as an undergraduate, right? Mm. And I don't think the British education system is that bad. But, I think it's really, it causes us then to have to up our game. So we see a lot of students come in, they're incredibly interested and passionate about sustainability, about health, about social justice, and they see science and technology as ways of achieving that. And that's a good thing for our state, because I think those are fundamentally what Hawaii needs, is people who are going to focus on those areas. And so the fact that we've got young people who are already exhibiting that passion, that's wonderful.
Well, I like how you position it, you know, how you helped frame it in terms of STEM within a liberal arts educational environment. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you know, as a local institution and specific to Chaminade, is there an area of focus, a specialty perhaps, or something that your program is really looking to nurture specifically in terms of preparing your students for STEM careers?
Yeah, so I came to Chaminade in 2007. And, you know, at that time, I think Chaminade seeing itself as an institution that did research, as an institution that did inquiry and was developing, you know, young STEM professionals. I don't think we had that vision of ourselves at that time. I mean, we hadn't renovated our lab since the 80s. I mean, things were different back then. Now, I think we're in a position, we've been strengthened by a lot of investment from federal agencies who really see the value in our mission, a lot of investment from donors, from foundations in Hawaii who see us, as you said, as an important part of the local kind of education framework. And so now I think we're in a strong position that when we see students come in, we can respond to what they're looking for in their careers. So our first big push, our first big build probably the first 5 years I was at Chaminade, it was really around biomedical. Environment and sustainability has sort of followed on from that. And now we're seeing young people who are interested in entrepreneurship and that kind of confluence of STEM entrepreneurship, who see maybe STEM careers in a wider and sort of more broad way than perhaps, you know, I was trained to see them. You know, what I was trained to do was go and work for a guy in a white coat in a lab somewhere. I think, you know, these young people, again, because of the job that the schools are doing and just the exposure they're getting, they're seeing this kind of broader menu of careers in front of them, like a kind of smorgasbord of STEM, and it's exciting.
Yeah, even in the local accelerator programs and such, you see more, not just app plays, not that there's anything wrong with that, or, you know, pure technology plays, but sustainability startups, energy startups, not simply to make money, but to have a positive impact on the community. So I can certainly see that confluence.
And the students today, they wear their kind of social justice on their sleeves, right? They want to be something, doing something where, yes, they're going to prosper, they're going to be able to support their families, but they want to do something that's worthwhile. I hear it over and over again. And so we keep coming back to, you know, health, social justice, sustainability, prosperity, mixing all of those together so that the students have this sort of sense that they can choose a career where they're going to be able to do something worthwhile. You know?
So I'm curious, Helen, you know, when you talk about STEM or you talk about entrepreneurship, does it get driven by the students and their interests and so the momentum that they perhaps bring to the, you know, to the class of, let's say, 2017 or 2018? Or is it the school really looking at STEM and looking at entrepreneurship as being the pathway upon which, you know, these students should be kind of directed? Which motivating factor is really at hand here?
I can tell you how I wish it was, and I can tell you how it is.
Okay. Nice.
I think I wish that we could be very flexible, very responsive to immediate community needs, to immediate things that the students are responding to. But, you know, academia, it's a glacially slow process to develop new curricula, to implement those new curricula, to validate that they work. So I understand, you know, why institutions find it hard and sometimes even pull back from sort of being too much on trend, right? And so I think that's a real challenge for universities and institutions of higher education, is how do we flex ourselves to be responsive, but without, you know, undermining the process that we know is good of how to validate a curriculum and make sure that it actually delivers the output that we're wanting to do. So, you know, what I think the place to do that then is in what you do in the curriculum is one venue for that, but then the sort of the trend towards what's value added in the curriculum. So, for example, if you have an undergraduate and they're going through a relatively traditional biology curriculum, there's no reason at all that research and internships and, you know, critical thinking activities and community outreach can't be added onto that. And one of the things we're trying to do is then figure out how do we give them, you know, the internet badges for that so that we can demonstrate to employers that they have all these sort of value added skills that, you know, otherwise the curriculum is just silent on that.
Is that like micro degrees or like certificate programs?
Yeah, I think that's a very exciting area.
Mm-hmm. Now, Scott, as the new workforce development coordinator for the community colleges system, certainly Bert now has engagement at UH, and we have a lot of opportunity to talk about how things are within the four-year degree programs there, or even the graduate or higher level research there. But certainly, I think when you talk about the community college system, it has a broader focus, a broader swath of the community that it includes in its programs. How would you articulate the vision you are bringing or helping to realize within the community college system in terms of workforce development in STEM?
So I think for myself, I don't know how new I am. I've been in this position now, I think, almost 5 years now.
Oh.
I actually left PCAT, I think, 2011. So, you know, maybe I shouldn't have said that because then I got to show some commitment to what we've done.
Yeah, so what have you accomplished?
So, yeah, what have you done, Scott? So, but, you know, to answer your question, Ryan, I think for myself, what I'm trying to look for is the collaboration between state agencies and the university and all of the players that make economic development possible. Because you have to remember that even though my title is focusing on workforce development, workforce development is just one of the elements of a larger economic ecosystem. So when on all of the factors of production coming together, one of which is workforce and labor, you're not going to see the economic expansion and economic opportunity, which means you will not see the jobs. So it really is a coordination effort in working with different agencies like the Chamber of Commerce, Hawaii Business Roundtable. I do quite a bit of work with the economic development boards on the counties, at all of the counties, as well as with our public workforce system.
So you mentioned PCAT. We've talked about their programs before, and I've had coworkers that have gone through the program. I would say a very traditional, very established in terms of networking, Cisco and programming or technology in that front. Perhaps similar to the way Helen talked about seeing this evolution, and certainly you've now evolved beyond PCAT. What are you seeing in terms of the trend from perhaps a traditional networking hardware degree or a program or certificate versus what students are pursuing or what they're interested in or maybe what they need for today's jobs?
So I think we've seen education from a traditional pipeline perspective. So our credit programs, our associate degrees, as well as the baccalaureate degrees. But there's a very important role that I think the University of Hawaii plays in workforce development. We do a lot of non-credit training that keeps the workforce up to date. That extends from everything from accounting, social work. It goes into fields such as, of course, computer networking, all of the advanced technology areas, healthcare. That's a critical element because non-credit workforce training allows us to get product to market in a much shorter time, allows us to make the necessary fine-tuning we need to the curriculum before we institutionalize something through the credit program. Because what Helen is saying is correct. Our time to market with traditional programs need to get vetted. We need to make sure that it meets the rigor that we are going to apply so that we can transition somebody from adolescence to adulthood into work and into the workforce. That's a really important responsibility for any institution of higher learning. The question is, how do we get product to market quickly? And a non-credit program allows us to do that. PCAT's a great example of that. But we have other programs that certainly also keep our current workforce and the incumbent workforce trained and skilled and ready to go.
So we're talking to Scott Murakami, and he's the Workforce Development Director over at the UH Community College program. And, of course, Helen Turner from from Chaminade, and she is the dean over at the Division of Natural Sciences and Mathematics over at Chaminade. And we're talking about STEM and workforce development. And if you have a comment or question, feel free to give us a call here. That number is 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. We want to welcome Carla from Kona to Bite Marks Cafe. Welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a question about, you were talking about coral. Do you have anything at all on the Kealakekua Bay coral?
That's
an excellent question. And we're going to have Ruth Gates come back on our show and probably have a little bit more in-depth conversation about the work that she's doing.
So stay tuned. Yes, unfortunately, the segment was over, so she has left the studio. But we will note that question specifically for our coral reefs conversation probably in about a month.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for
the
call.
Yeah, so tune in. And, of course, you can also catch her distinguished lecture series coming up. And, of course, we'll post that on our show notes later on tonight. But, so getting back to the discussion at hand. So Scott, when you start talking about sort of, you know, getting product to market quicker, does it have, you know, that's more driven by the demand of the, let's say, the employers in Hawaii.
Yes.
I'm curious, how do you get feedback from them as to what it is that they need?
You know, specifically in the STEM area, the University of Hawaii just received a $4.6 million grant from USA Funds. And the intention behind that grant was to focus specifically in STEM industries and build, there were four parts to it, but one of the largest component was to build a very innovative industry sector-based analysis process. So basically, what we're looking at is how do we engage business, right? That's been the traditional question that we've asked through workforce. And I think what we're looking at is how do we change that question to how do we create value for businesses? Mm-hmm. And in doing that, we have to understand what their needs are. Just like any other business, right, our core competence is producing the labor force that Hawaii needs. So to do that, what we're looking at is working with both the Hawaii Business Roundtable, the Chamber of Commerce, as well as some consultants to come in and have some structured conversations about specifically what their needs are immediately so we can address that through our non-credit workforce training programs, but also look at what the pathways are. Mm. Do you have enough students coming through that are going to meet your demands into the future? And that's a tough question. You know, you have to remember STEM fields change pretty rapidly. So how do we solve tomorrow's problems when we don't even know what they're going to be yet, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why having this discussion with business and industry in a very structured way that creates independence, greater independence than we have now, because we do utilize a lot of advisory boards and we see some mixed results from that. Mm-hmm. Bringing in independence in it, having it done by an organization like the Hawaii Business Roundtable and supported by the Chamber of Commerce ensures that we're hearing from all businesses throughout the state, mm-hmm. both large and small.
Now, Helen, I saw you nodding when Scott was talking about non-credit courses and sort of more flexibility perhaps when you're still trying to develop something that is more vetted and more set for a formal curriculum. So did you have any thoughts on that from the Chaminade point of view?
Yeah, I think those things are very exciting. And I think it if you think about it, you know, Scott and I were talking about just before we came in here is that, you know, these days the sort of 18-year-old traditional student is kind of a unicorn, right? Most people who are in higher education, especially in Hawaii, they are post-traditional, non-traditional students. And for them, you know, the upskilling, the very flexible schedules that you can have doing courses online, hybrid, on ground. I mean, that's how you democratize education. You make it really accessible to people who need it. And it helps build people's families and communities because you're letting them build their ability to earn, you know, a decent wage. And I really commend that. I think that's something that's so important. I wanted to follow on, you know, Scott's point about the you know, going out to employers. So one of the things that I think we've sort of been wringing our hands about in the STEM field for a lot of years is that, you know, over time, you graduate a certain number of people with a STEM degree. You look 10 years later, not many of them are in STEM, right? And we've been worrying about that as bleed, as attrition, as loss. But I think what we're really starting to understand now and what new research is telling us is that it's really, as Ruth would say, a glass half full thing, because students are and graduates are going out and they're incredibly desirable to a really diverse swath of employers. That the skills that a STEM thinker has when they emerge from a STEM degree, you know, these are people who are quantitative, they're analytical, they're critical, they have passion for their work, and they don't have a monopoly on that. That's not what I'm saying. But, you know, they consistently rank very high in the employer desired skill sets. You know, we graduate as student, the chances are if they come through one of our STEM degrees, they will have presented at a national conference. Mm-hmm. They have incredible communication skills. And so that's why we're seeing these very sort of broad distributions of STEM graduates in, again, not necessarily working for a guy in a white coat in a lab, right? And I think that's something I'm glad that we're actually going out and reaching out to those employers and getting their data.
So Helen, what you just said is interesting, because I was going to ask Scott about, you know, the idea of turning a product quickly and, you know, looking at satisfying, let's say, an employer's need through a community college program. But Helen, I think what you're getting at is the fact that, you know, if an employer doesn't necessarily have a whole bunch of jobs for, let's say, somebody in biology or, mm-hmm. or chemistry, but they do have a certain amount of desired work requirements that are addressed by somebody that has graduated with STEM background, that is, you know, in and of itself a fulfilling, let's say, connection between what the graduate has done and what the employer needs.
Right. And so I think, you know, we, you know, as educators, I think we look at ourselves and we say, are we trying to produce graduates who sort of just make the same career choices we did? And, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. you know, some will. I mean, we produce students every year who they go off, they do PhD. But I think more likely the situation is they're going to take what they've learned and they're going to apply it in either science in the broader sense or a very particular set of sort of integrating and synthetic skills that they have that become very desirable to employers. And I think that's something that maybe, you know, when we start seeing the feedback coming from employers, if we collect data on, okay, was this person, yes, they came to you and they had great communication skills, they're a critical thinker, they're a problem solver, do they do a STEM degree, then I think we get some really interesting information out of that. And as I said, it's not to say that STEM graduates have the monopoly on those kinds of skills, but I think there is a strong linkage there between desirability to what a lot of employers are looking for.
You know, what I want to explore after the break is that I want to see how do we kind of tackle that same, fulfillment of the need for attracting some of those graduates that have graduated from high school here, perhaps gone to the mainland, and now how do we kind of attract them back? So we want to hold that thought. We'll be right back after this short break to continue our conversation with Helen Turner and Scott Murakami about STEM and workforce development.
Of course, we'd love to hear from you, too. You can call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 from the Neighbor Islands. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Hi, I'm Steve Tabusi with First Insurance Company of Hawaii. We do see a relationship amongst all of the underwriters of Hawaii Public Radio in building our community, and Hawaii Public Radio is one of those vital institutions that sits right in the middle of that nexus between our business interests and our community interests.
Hawaii Public Radio, celebrating partnership, building community.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Locke Kelly, author of Shift into Freedom. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about the science and practice of open-hearted awareness.
Sunday morning at 11. Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Nohea Gallery and Kaiser Permanente.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa, and we're talking to Helen Turner and Scott Murakami about Hawaii STEM education and career pathways.
And of course, you can give us a call too. That number is 941-3689 on Oahu and 877-941-3689 from the Neighbor Islands. And right before the break,
we were talking about workforce development, specifically how skills that you learn pursuing a STEM degree or participating in a STEM program can be applied to various jobs. So, Scott, I want to ask you to do some myth-busting for me, especially when you talk about, the evolution from PCAD and, say, Cisco networking classes to a more broader menu. I liked what Helen said about, you know, if they come out of a program with a biology degree, then they've probably presented papers at a conference. They're probably excellent communicators. I would say that a lot of people maybe 10, 15 years ago would assume the opposite of somebody with what you would call like a technical degree or an engineering degree, that either they're an egghead or they're a weirdo geek. There was TV commercials that talked about the IT guy with purple hair, no social skills, but you had to keep him around because he could fix the copier. So what are you seeing in terms of a diverse skill set from a STEM program that could be, that you could sell an employer even if they weren't specifically looking for a STEM graduate?
Sure. I think the biggest demonstration of how it's changed over the years is just watch Big Bang Theory, right? Now it's cool to be a nerd. But, I think from my side, you have to look at it, from my perspective, you have to look at it in terms of what skills are portable, right? Just because somebody goes to a particular degree program doesn't necessarily mean they're bound and restricted by those career options, right? I myself got my MBA in finance and my master's in accounting, but I don't work in either finance and accounting. But it helps me to understand ROI, the need for interpretation of policy through accounting. It helps me to understand how the bigger economic picture works and how these different factors, the financial crisis in China, right, the capitulation in the market earlier this year, how that all affects our economy, and subsequently, what does that mean for the local individual who wants the job? I think it's really what's fascinated me about this, and I think, Helen, you're absolutely right. The fascinating thing is that we live in a very, very data-driven world. The one redeeming quality I find in people who come to work with us are people who actually are they're evidence-based people. And what that means is they don't react to numbers, right? They don't react to either quantitative or qualitative data. The data is what the data is. But then they go through this methodical process of thinking it through and saying, So this is what it actually tells me, and this is what I need to do to make it better. I think that process applies to a lot of different higher level positions that these STEM graduates are eventually migrating to. And that's a great opportunity for them.
Mm-hmm. Now, Helen, I wanted to explore a little bit about the idea that you can graduate perhaps with a STEM degree. You know, it could be any of the sciences or in engineering. But when you get placed in a job, and if your research is sort of finding that they are highly qualified, but the job may not be in the specific area that they may have, you know, done their coursework in. Is that kind of a coincidence, or is it just by happenstance that that might occur, or is there some purposeful sort of direction that is involved with having that student or graduate sort of in that education and then employment path?
I think it depends. So I think the intentionality is evolving. I think that we, for you know, a long time, I think that we were a little bit guilty in the STEM field of ourselves having a very closed view and thinking that what our job was to produce, again, people who made the same decisions mm-hmm. we did and go off, they do PhDs. And that idea that you kind of got to clone yourself as an educator, I think that's something that we've moved away from. I think the better schools, the better colleges are really trying to present the students from day one with this whole smorgasbord, this whole constellation of potential career options, and also not placing judgment. You know, so if I have a student who comes in and says, you know, I don't want to go to medical school, but I want to do healthcare policy, then, you know, then the challenge is how do you tailor their educational experience to fit that particular desire. If you have students who come in and they wish to, they wish to just go on a voyage of discovery in their undergraduate, you know, there's a lot of pressure on students to decide, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. be 18, know what you're going to do for the rest of your life. And, you know, again, I think it takes a certain kind of institutional bravery to say, okay, we're going to work with you through this. We're going to equip you with those highly portable skills while we give you exposure to things, and you can figure out what it is you want to do at the end of the day. And so, you know, I think that is then that tension between the sort of the old ways of just pouring content, domain-specific content into students in those first 2 years versus a perhaps newer model of saying, let's concentrate on the portable skills, help them figure it out, and then they're going to be equipped so that when we do come in with heavy content, they're ready for it, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, there's just a lot of things getting mm-hmm. turned on their heads in education, especially higher education.
Well,
right,
you know,
now.
Look at Bert. Great school, great degree, electrical yeah. engineer. Today, he's a handsome radio host. He's a television go-go dancer. He's an open data gladiator. All
and,
things that
and
you
who
might
would have guessed you right. needed an electrical engineering
exactly.
degree.
Exactly. Yeah. So Scott, you talked about those portable degrees, and you talked about interacting with the employer. So how do you say to an employer who goes, wow, you know, we're really trying to find the right public relations person, and you can say, hey, well, this guy with an electrical engineering degree would be a great fit for that job. I mean, how do you help them think more broadly like
so
that?
We are looking at a couple of things. One of the things that we're looking at how do we infuse more data intelligence into our program development aspects. So we're using a number of new tools that do both economic forecasting using jobs as a unit of measure to tell us where we think the jobs are going to be in the future. Not only that, it can tell us what the knowledge, skills, and abilities are that people are looking for. That's one tool that we're looking at. But the other one that we're looking at is a new real-time LMI data or labor market information tool. And basically what it does is it goes out on the web, spiders the web for different job postings, scrubs them, normalizes all the data, puts it into a database, and allows you to query it based off of different types of skill sets, right? But it makes the tie back to the employer. So the nice thing, it's a big data tool. It's cleaning up all of this dirty data, right? Scrubs it up, cleans it so that we can then query it. So let's take an example, a real-life example, right? You talk about cybersecurity now. Cybersecurity infiltrates every single industry in the state. So the question is, how do you find an expert how do we start defining what cybersecurity is? How do we start identifying what the skills are and who's actually looking for these people? So we can go into this real-time data tool, query cybersecurity, and pop up every single ad that's online that with a tie back to the employer as to who's looking for somebody with the skills, some type of skill or reference to cybersecurity. We're using that type of intelligence and presenting it to employers and saying, validate this for us. Is this really what you're looking for, right? Once we can get that squared away, we're looking at other types of tools that help us do job placement and job matching with employers in like a Web 2.0 environment. So they can create a community with a student who's online saying, hey, I'm in this major. I'm looking at these different things. You know, I see that you've got an ad here in this system, and I'm interested in applying for it. It doesn't just apply to just job placement. You can do it with internships, with on-the-job training opportunities. So basically what we're trying to do is solve this problem in a couple of ways. One, using greater data labor market intelligence to get information, quantitative information aggregated in a way that we can present it to employers, and then complementing that with the qualitative information from employers and saying, is this really what you need? Then we're going to build this program and subsequently have the individual trained.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a little bit about the other end of that pipeline then. And Helen, I'm going to ask you an impossible question. So I have a daughter. She's 18. She's graduating in May. She's thinking maybe communications, maybe theater, looking at different schools. And, of course, I'm a geek, and I'm like, but, you know, there's these STEM careers, these STEM areas of study, and you shouldn't just write off engineering or math or biology or science like that. As you're talking about not creating clones of ourselves on the other end, mm-hmm. How do you perhaps make a more welcome, bigger welcome mat for students that might not, by the same token, even consider a STEM education path when they're coming out of high school?
I was actually talking to her outside. She's a fantastic young lady. Well, and I was actually pushing UH's theater programs because they have the kind of, you know, the fusion of East and West theater. And I think that's – so anyway, I did that.
Okay, so you're going against
it. Sorry about that. I didn't realize – I didn't get the memo that we were pushing engineering. I didn't realize that.
Just to consider it, I mean, really, how do you open those minds if they didn't go through, for example, the great robotics programs or mm-hmm. the programs that are kind of generating that kind of excitement at the high school level?
I think it's myth busting, you know, as you said earlier. I think the idea, it's giving students and prospective students a visualization of what actually being a scientist, for example, being a physician is really like. I think some of the misconceptions I see are a lot around quantitative. So, you know, it's certainly true that, you know, science degrees demand a certain amount of quantitative skills. They demand a certain amount of math. But it's by no means the kind of be-all and end-all. And I think that's really changing now. The fact, I mean, I can't remember the last time I submitted a grant that didn't have a social science component to it. I have a data visualization, data scientist specialist who works for me. And, you know, he's an amazing scientist, but he's also kind of part artist, right? Because mm-hmm. he is developing these aesthetically beautiful visualizations of very complex data. And so I think, you know, we have a job now, I'm sort of speaking as a practicing scientist, not so much as an educator. I think scientists have this responsibility to communicate what the life lived is really like. You know, you hear Ruth talk about, you know, she dives, she does these amazing things, the travel, the diversity of people that you get to interact with on a day-to-day basis. You know, I think getting that visualization of what science really is and why it's such an incredibly interesting and exciting career. And it is a broad church. I mean, to go back to what you were saying about, you know, the myth busting that, you know, everyone has to be a nerd with purple hair. I you know, when I did my PhD, the lab that I was in, there were 13 people in it, 11 different nationalities, right? And you get to really see people from all over the world, different socioeconomic backgrounds, and also distributed on that axis of being very communicative, very socially out there versus maybe a little more introverted. And science accepts all those people. I mean, you can find a place in this sort of this kind of constellation of different roles and careers in science. So I think, you know, if I was talking, and I was before I pushed her into theater, you know, talking to an 18-year-old about why to go into science, I think it's what you're going to do with it, not the process of going through the degree, right? Gotcha.
You know, I got a question, but I'm going to save that question because I want to get Jerry on the line from Maui to ask his question. Welcome to Bite Marks Cafe, Jerry.
Aloha, boys. Good to be back on the show.
Well, good.
Maui Makers. What's up?
My question for the two folks today is actually ties them together with a little bit of Helen's background in the microbiology. On the mainland, there's a huge growing startup community around the new genetics and microbiology and neuroscience and so forth. Are there any activities in that area that you're aware of and pushing that are things we could do to help develop it, aside from starting our own biocoder labs here in Hawaii?
Excellent question.
Thanks, Jerry.
Good to hear from you, Jerry.
I saw an ad on Kickstarter today. It came up on my Facebook, and it was for a bio bento. And what it is, it's about the size of a large bento box. You can buy it for, I think it was like $99, and it basically contains a small molecular biology lab that you could do anywhere. I mean, it's just amazing.
And you can imagine deploying that for a classroom or something.
For classrooms, and then for the whole sort of citizen science movement. I mean, I think that in terms of, you know, your question, Jerry, what exactly is going on? So I think if you look at the sort of the highest, you know, people who already have established research in those kinds of areas, you know, we've seen a number of really kind of transformative hires of really heavy hitting scientists come into Hawaii in the last few years. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, never forget that we have an R1 research institution here that's, you know, very desirable place to come and do science. And we've seen some amazing people come in, you know, especially in microbial diversity. We have some really amazing genetics epigeneticists at the medical school. But thinking at my level, which is primarily the sort of undergraduate level, you know, but Chaminade, we're primarily we're trying to recruit people who definitely have background in those kind of emerging fields. But we're after those kind of unicorns who want to actually teach with it, right? Mm-hmm, and that's a sometimes a tough thing. But we found some really amazing people. We have interest in microbial diversity, but in the application to forensic sciences. Ah. That's a big thing for us right now. We have a guy who works on. We brought him in from Nebraska, and he works on using microbial populations to figure out how long something's been dead.
Ooh. Ah, yeah. I can see the CSI episode now. Scott, did you have any thoughts on Jerry's question?
You know, Jerry, I'm hoping that I'm hearing what you're saying correctly, but I think part of the question is how do we scale, right? I think it's important to recognize the science, not just the science, but also the business environment that allows us to scale, because whether it's in, you know, microbial studies or any type of other science, the question is how do we take it to market, right? How do we get the whole STEM, how do we get the whole STEM and innovation economy going so that it is really an economic opportunity that allows us to diversify the economy? I think some of the things that would benefit Hawaii from scaling those types of industries are, for one thing, you know, if you look at studies at entry-level positions for STEM education, right? So somebody coming out with a BA plus degree gets about a 26% premium over somebody in a non-STEM field.
Right.
So we know that there are great opportunities for employment in those areas. I really think it's a question of getting back to what you asked me initially, Ryan, about the vision. What do I see? I really see it's an opportunity for everyone to come together and make that industry sector thrive.
Well, you know, I think this is going to be a call for another maybe show on sort of the STEM economy, and I want to explore that. But later on, we'll save that for another show. Helen Turner is from Chaminade University and Scott Murakami from the University of Hawaii Community College's Office of Workforce Development, and we want to thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Join us next week when we will revisit the Solar Impulse experience.
And of course, if you miss any part of this edition, you can find the podcast of tonight's show on bitemarkscafe.org. And if you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to email us at feedback@bitemarks.org. And of course, you can also find us on Twitter. I'm at @BiteMarks.
And you can follow me at Hawaii. Our engineer is Rob Carlisle, and our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And we leave you with our song pick of the week. Here's a band called The Wild Swans and a song called Archangels. See you next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe.